Why do I conduct my show on this manner? Mondo!
Sweet mother of God, what is the holdup?
Eleanor!
Once again, something wonderful in my life has been turned into a giant crap fest.
Mondo!
Got a little bit more cock for you here.
Eleanor!
Bowtie boy got the big snaggeroonie.
Mondo!
Oh, six of my nipples are tingling.
Eleanor!
See why America loves him so much?
Mondo!
I'd like to smash you in the face with my shillelagh.
Eleanor!
I have no idea what's going on.
Mondo!
He was lying.
He said he never tells a lie.
He was lying when he said that.
Eleanor!
I want a cup.
Well, could you spell that?
C-U-P. I want to see you. Oh, my God.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Stomach batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
For God's sake, strap yourself down.
Right, it's the show your bosses don't want you to listen to, the show that's going to tell you the truth about what's going on in the workplace. So wake the hell up. It's the Cup of Joe radio show. I am your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man, the voice of the radical middle, and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Our engineer, Sock Puppet Sam, is here.
Hey, Joe, what do you know?
And we've got a lot of stuff to talk about. But before we do that, Sam, give us the URL for the site.
That's cupojoe.blogspot.com.
And the email address.
joevec@bellsouth.net.
Okay, once again, I want to welcome all my fans listening in at the White Rose Society. My thanks to my good friend Ben Birch for hosting my archives there. Also, my listeners at rantradio.com and cadronpictures.com. And now I hear from my friends at Cadron Pictures that they also are no longer operative, although I will keep them on the board, on the site, and in the radio show in hopes that they will come back. And first Radio Power, now Cadron Pictures. They're all going away! I still have rantradio.com, and of course I have my new all music radio show, Audio Hell, which is on Saturdays from 4 to 6 at cammafia.com. That's cam-mafia.com. And that's a pretty good site. They got a lot of interesting little shows there. Of course, mine is the best. Thank you very much. Of course, mine is the best because I play all the cool music. They play the same music over and over again. I play the cool music, damn it. I play the cool music. It is July 4th, as I speak, 8:07 in the p.m. And we were going to go down to see some fireworks, but we had been out already. We saw the Spider-Man movie today, and I just didn't feel like going out anymore. And my wife is kind of wishing she could go with her kids to see the fireworks. So we're just going to spend a nice, quiet evening at home. I'm finishing up the show here, and I'm just going to relax. Maybe we'll watch a movie or something on the TV. I don't know what we're going to do at present. And I'm sure a lot of you are busy enjoying the 4th of July holiday. Of course, it's a Sunday, which means maybe some of you will still have to work Monday. Maybe some of you are off Friday. Maybe some of you won't be working on Monday, like I just said. I personally will be off all next week because that's when our plant has its annual shutdown. And unfortunately, I am forced to use my vacation time. I only have 3 vacation days, and I'm forced to use it during this time. I cannot take it at another time. I can get paid for it at a later date in some screwy fashion, which means if I wait, I can get paid a little bit extra, but I figured, what the hell, I need the money coming in for the week, even if it's only 3 days worth. So my finger is still healing, but this new splint is much better than what I had before. Digsby's blog, Hullabaloo, and you can see that on my on the site. That's cupojoe.blogspot.com, as Sam told you earlier. He posted a great quote from Sam Adams. And I want to read that quote to you because it's a really wonderful quote from one of our founding fathers, Samuel Adams. And he said, "If you love wealth greater than liberty, the tranquility of servitude greater than the animating contest for freedom, go home from us in peace. We seek not your counsel nor your arms. Crouch down and lick the hand that feeds you. May your chains set lightly upon you, and may posterity forget that you were our countrymen." And I want to remind all my listeners of that saying. To stand up and fight in however means you can, using whatever means you can, against what you feel is wrong, is the essence of what being an American is about. Even though we disagree with what they say, our foes on the right, our friends on the right, too, because in the long run, they still are our friends. They still are our countrymen. They are exercising their rights as Americans, too. Even though what they say and what they believe goes against what we believe it means to be an American. Because many of them stand for things that, in my opinion, go against the very beliefs of Americans. They stand for the selfishness of the ages that drives people against one another. We stand for the communion of humankind, not just as Americans, but as global citizens. And we have to recognize that in the future days. The world is changing. And although while these may seem to be dark times right now, the world is changing. And things are happening that in the long run are going to be in our favor. It doesn't matter how bad the Bush administration screws things up, and they are screwing things up very badly for us, and only the diehard supporters of the Bush people understand. Excuse me, only the diehard Bush supporters fail to understand how much damage is being done to our economy, to our national image abroad, and they really don't really care to hear any other side of the story. And that's sad for them, because we have some very strong points. We have some very good points. We need to be listened to. And we're not being listened to. And that's the problem. And in the past, we have not properly listened to what they have had to say. And while what a lot of what they say is racist trash, and I'll say that again, there are things that we can find common ground on. And it's unfortunate in this day and age that we live in such polarized times that people simply can't talk to one another in a civil manner. You know, there was a shouting match going on the comments section. Thank you. Why can't I think of the right word? Between B-Chan and Steve and Mike and others. And they were just going left after each other, left and right. And I'm like, look, let's not go crazy about this. And then Ted Rall came up with that cartoon that's on the blog there, where it seems like lately it's impossible to talk to one another without calling each other names. This 4th of July, I'd like everybody to reflect upon what Mr. Adams said and what you think is the true spirit of America. To me, the true spirit doesn't lie in a flag, a piece of paper. It doesn't lie in rote recitation of words that we don't understand. It lies with understanding the words that we're reciting. It lies in understanding why we wrote the Declaration of Independence, why the Constitution was written the way it was, and why rule of law and self-rule are such important things. We live by the law, and we elect people to uphold the law. And we don't elect people to be dictators over us. Mr. Bush may think he has the power to do what he wills, but he'll realize eventually, like all dictators and potential dictators, that power is an illusion. And those who wield it will find that it's a two-edged sword and that it will strike them just as well. All right, let's take a break, and I'll be back with an interview here on the Cup of Joe Radio Show.
We'll be right back with more of the Cup of Joe Radio Show.
Welcome back to the BuzzFlash.com GOP Hypocrite of the Week. If we could, we'd make Dick Cheney our Hypocrite of the Week every week. Dick, along with Rehnquist and Scalia, are the epicenter of GOP hypocrisy, exemplifying the true elitist sense of entitled rule, repeatedly violating our Constitution and democracy with bad judgment, dishonesty, and in the case of Cheney, shameless self-profiteering. When you look back over the years, Rehnquist was integral in making the Ken Starr impeachment frame-up happen when he appointed the fanatically right-wing federal judge David Sentell to the court that oversaw the independent counsel. It was Sentell who led the judicial coup at the urging of Jesse Helms that forced out respected IC Robert Fisk and replaced him with the self-righteous geek hatchet man for Richard Mellon-Scaife's Arkansas project, Ken Starr. Then, of course, Scalia stole the 2000 election for Bush and Cheney and continues to duck hunt and have social encounters with Cheney, even ruling in Dick's favor on the issue of the infamous Energy Task Force. Of course, we all know that Cheney and Scalia are doing business when they meet socially at the expense of democracy. And that brings us back to Cheney, this week's hypocrite honoree. Earlier this week, we thanked him for empowering us to yell out at the top of our lungs, "Go fuck yourself, Dick Cheney." You see, Cheney said that vomiting an expletive at the meek Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy made Dick feel better. But it's the Bush administration and their GOP enablers who always deride the mythical liberal elite for allegedly doing whatever makes them feel good instead of what is the responsible thing to do. But for Dick Cheney, who fashions himself master of the universe, saying whatever you want, even vulgarities hurled at the Senate floor at an upstanding U.S. senator, is just fine if it makes him feel better. Who gives a hypocritical fuck about responsible behavior? Dick's use of the F-word epitomizes the hypocrisy of the entire GOP neo-Confederacy political relations strategy of family values. They don't give a fuck about family values. All they care about is seizing and maintaining power to enrich themselves and impose their view of a divinely ruled kingdom on America. Cheney wasn't just telling Senator Leahy to go fuck yourself, as one of our BuzzFlash readers noted. His real audience was us, the citizens of America. I think Dick Cheney's remark to Senator Patrick Leahy sums up the Bush administration's general attitude toward most average American citizens, as well as the rest of the world, said reader Alan Pittner. I think Bush and company have basically told all of us outside the neoconservative realm to go fuck yourselves. So, as our reader notes, Cheney wasn't just showing their neo-Confederacy white guy voters how macho he could be. He was, essentially, giving the finger to all of us who serve as vassals in their Halliburton-Carlyle group Bush monarchy. In doing so, maybe his hypocrisy cleared the way for a little truth-telling, and every American voter can feel that same sense of accomplishment as Senator Leahy, because Dick was just being himself, telling us all to go fuck ourselves. Until next week, remember the BuzzFlash slogan, "So many Republican hypocrites, so little time." Catch up with you soon.
The Cup of Joe Radio Show will be right back.
And we're back on the Cup of Joe Radio Show. I am your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man, the voice of the radical middle, and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Again, my URL is cupojoe.blogspot.com, and please email me at joevec@bellsouth.net. Okay, you can tell by the sound quality that I am once again on the phone. As you know, I do the occasional interview, and I have the honor of having with me today here in the wonderful Jove Enterprises studios, Mr. David Bornstein, who has written a wonderful book called How to Change the World, Social Entrepreneurs in the New Age. How are you, sir?
I'm terrific. How are you?
Great, great. I really enjoyed your book, and I wanted to talk to you about this because I mentioned that I was a member of the Radical Middle, and Mark Satton wrote the book The Radical Middle, and while I'm a working-class person, I consider myself to be somebody who likes to find practical solutions to problems. And first of all, I want to say that your book really humbled me because all these people doing all this extraordinary work just makes me feel completely and utterly useless. Just sitting here doing this little internet radio show is about the best that I can do right now. But there are a lot of wonderful examples, including Florence Nightingale. I hadn't even thought of her as being a social entrepreneur. Now, let's go into the definition of that. How do you consider someone to be a social entrepreneur?
Well, social entrepreneur is really, it's really just someone who has the creativity, the drive, and the ethics to build something that really solves problems in a new way. You know, everybody knows what an entrepreneur is, you know, a person who goes out there and they start a business and with some innovative quality, not just any ordinary business, but something that's a little different, usually is implied by entrepreneur, sort of a new recipe. Well, the same qualities that somebody has that allow them to be a successful entrepreneur. And what is that? That's basically taking the initiative. It means the ability to mobilize resources, to build a team, to get people to join you, and also to be able to see sort of an idea or a possibility slightly over the horizon that most people don't yet see, so that you're sort of leaping forward on your hunch of something that will work that most people or many people are still skeptical of. All of those sort of brew of qualities applies to people who want to make profit but also want to build something to you know, change something in society, and that could be helping low-income kids get into college or creating a network to protect street children in India or providing opportunities, working and living opportunities to people with disabilities or building a better political movement so that people who feel that their voices don't matter can organize in a better way to really affect the political system. All of those things are some of the, you know, are things that social entrepreneurs today are doing. And in your field, you know, publicizing and getting the word out and educating people about new ideas that are out there, new ways of thinking, is also something that many social entrepreneurs are doing. So don't sell yourself short. You never know where a cup of Joe might be in 10 years.
Well, I hope it's a little bigger than a little studio in my bedroom right here. Well, what kind of obstacles do social entrepreneurs face? I mean, obviously, because I talk about on my show how government is the problem as much as big corporations and big business is the problem. Do social entrepreneurs face trouble from both of these ends?
Basically, governments and big businesses are actually a lot more in common than we all often think. Typically, they're both pretty bureaucratic very often. Even big businesses, which prides itself on being so innovative, you find that most of the innovation in society and the economy comes from smaller businesses. And it makes sense intuitively. When somebody is starting a smaller business or is running their own shop, you think of Steve Jobs in his garage with his computer, you know that they're crazily obsessed with their idea. They're up at 2 a.m. thinking about it. They're up again at 6 a.m. in the morning because they can't wait to get started trying the thing that they thought of in the middle of the night. They're very excited. They're running on caffeine. And they're willing to try things that no management committee would ever try because of the typical conservatism of people working in groups. That applies both to the government and actually to large companies run by managers. And it's one of the reasons why you see so little innovation in corporations when it comes to improving the way that they are with the environment, for example. So the obstacles that social entrepreneurs run into are basically lack of belief that change is possible, lack of people willing to take risks to help them out when they're starting off and they haven't yet proven their ideas. I'll give you one example. J.B. Schramm is the founder of an organization called College Summit. I have a chapter on them in my book.
Right.
And his organization helps low-income kids in the United States, low-income high school graduates, attend college. They help them get into college. Now, it's a little different than Canada. In the United States, the college application system, there's thousands, I think there's more than 10,000 colleges in the United States, and there's millions of kids every year that apply to them. And it's really like a marketplace. You have to apply to the right college, and you have to advocate for yourself in a very specific and effective way, or that matching process won't take place. Well, what J.B. Schramm has found is that low-income kids in the United States who graduate from high school only enroll in college at the rate of 46% nationally in the United States. So that means more than half aren't going. Now, in the U.S. as well as in Canada, if you don't go to college today in this day and age, you're basically marginalized in society. There's a huge section of the economy that's not open to you anymore. And the United States, the census has found that if you go to college, you'll earn $1 million more over your working life than if you just graduate from high school. Also, your kids are twice as likely to go to college.
So right.
Going to college is really, you know, you can really say it ends poverty in a family line. It's one of the most important interventions you can make in a low-income person's life, especially if their parents didn't go to college. So why are we losing 54% of high school graduates who aren't going to college? Well, JB found that in many cases, the system is screwed up. It's not the system of helping to get kids into college in a low-income public school is basically one guidance counselor for 500 or maybe 1,000 kids, which is unworkable. The other thing is that most kids in the United States who go to college, they get a lot of help from their parents, too. They get all this nagging. You know, honey, you can't send that application in with a coffee stain on it. You know, or where's the essay? You promised you'd show me your essay, and, you know, is it written yet? That kind of nagging, that kind of management, home management role, for low-income kids where their parents didn't go to college and may not expect their children to go to college, that kind of nagging role often is missing.
And I can point from a personal experience. My parents grew up during the Depression, and they were very poor and didn't have anybody who had ever gone to college in their family. In fact, neither my mother nor my father graduated high school, so they had no idea about even how to nag myself and my brother and my sister on how to go to college. My sister eventually went on her own much later in her life. But yes, you're exactly right. If you don't go to college in this country, you are definitely, missing out on a lot of things that you could do, because there's a lot of people that even if you can show some degree of intelligence, that they simply won't touch you unless you have that college education.
Right, or those networks. What you're saying is exactly right. JB started working. He was working in this teen center in Washington, D.C., a low-income housing project where they had a teen center. And he found that there were about 60 kids in his teen center every year, and on average, two of them were straight-A students, and they went to college because the colleges actually called them up. Colleges are looking for low-income talent. There were 20 kids who weren't college-ready. They just hadn't done the work. And then there were always about 40 in the middle who were sort of middle grades, their SAT scores weren't so great. That's the standard, that's the Scholastic Aptitude Test. But they often had really, really tremendous personal strength, like they were leaders, or they were courageous, or they were artists, or they took care of their younger brothers and sisters because both their parents worked full-time or something like that. And he said, these kids really should be going to college. So he created a little program just to help four of them to get in, and all four got in. He did the same thing the following year, and all four got in again. So he thought, like an entrepreneur at this point, instead of sticking with four more, he said, I have to figure out a way to bottle this. And he pulled in a bunch of other people, and he developed a system. And the following year, he did it with 30 students, and 80% of them enrolled in college. So that was in 1996. Over the last 8 years, College Summit has spread. It's now worked with more than 5,000 students. It still has an 80% college admission rate. They've now branched out. They're in half a dozen cities across the United States, and they're spreading to more. And they're now working with scores of public schools, scores of colleges across the country, and public school administrators in a whole variety of cities to rebuild, essentially, college guidance systems using this system that they developed. And they still have an 80% college admission rate after working with thousands of kids. They also have an 80% retention rate, meaning the kids are staying in college. So this is, I think, what J.B. Schramm and College Summit is doing is very similar to what, Henry Ford and Steve Jobs did, which is essentially they taking a product that is, in a sense, is a bit of a luxury item, and they're making it more of a mass market item. Okay? And the way you do that is you have to change the distribution channels of that item. You have to change the pricing of it. You have to change the way it's essentially being marketed. That's a quirky way to think about college access, but it actually turns out to be a very effective way of thinking through the challenges that the social entrepreneur faces. And, the obstacles along the way, disbelief, nobody would fund him initially. He had to go to 25 people before he could get the money to initially try and do this stuff. The colleges, he had trouble getting to working with them initially. High schools didn't want to work with him. The college counselors thought that his system was wasn't exactly the right way that they do college counseling. Everybody basically disagreed with him at first and put up obstacles, and it was a long, long process of having conversations and conversations persuading people to give him a chance.
What I find interesting about the entire thing is how you talk about how everybody takes a business attitude towards these what are primarily social issues. I've read, although I'm not a big fan of Ayn Rand, and you know her philosophy was always if everybody acts in their own self-interest, everything will just sort of working out. But these people are not acting. Mr. Schramm, for example, is not acting necessarily in his own specific self-interest, although he would get benefits of a better society in the long run. He's looking to help other people, and he's using his business skills in that sense to help other people out. And it's a very kind of giving spirit as opposed to the taking spirit of the selfishness that we see in these times someday. Do you think in our polarized atmosphere that we have right now that more and more of this is going to come up, or are people going to get more and more selfish as college becomes more difficult, as tuitions rise and things like that?
I tend to think that the two things that shape behavior in a society more than anything else are status and shame. And to the degree, people are natural status seekers. They want to move towards things that everybody else is going to applaud. And they move away from things that everybody else says is bad. So if you take away the shame component, say for example in the accounting profession, you'll get a lot of bad behavior. People doing things that 10, 15 years ago they wouldn't have done because their colleagues would have looked down upon them, like all that phony dealing with WorldCom and Enron, for example.
Right.
Similarly, people seek status. If you take if you start elevating the suicide bombers in a society and giving them status and making them sort of very famous or applauded figures, you will get lots of people who want to be that, so that their families are thought well of. And we've seen that in the world too. So what do we do with social entrepreneurship? Is a fantastic way to apply entrepreneurial ability. As you said, the same entrepreneurial ability, the same ways and it's not just business skills. It's really, it's much more about initiative and drive and creativity and, thinking, coming up with new and better recipes, not just doing more cooking, you know? Those talents are in abundance in almost every society that is free, that allows people to do the things that they can do. They're in abundance in Brazil today, in India, in the United States, in Canada, in Poland. Pretty much everywhere you look where societies have become newly free, you have this upsurge of people wanting to use their freedom to build things. That's the most basic thing. If you watch a two-year-old with blocks, people love to build things. They just, I think it's probably innate.
Kids also love to throw blocks at people too.
They love to throw. so it's so to the degree that we can, you know, talk about the social entrepreneurs and get people excited and see, wow, we can really build things. We don't actually have to just rely on the government to try and fix the society or redistribute income. We can actually come up with better ways of protecting children. We can, you know, in the United States, there's a lot of experiments with what they call charter schools. These are people, in many cases, that are creating their own schools. And, you know, there's a lot of debate about whether this is really bad for the public school system. I think, ultimately, it's going to be good because you have many new kinds of experiments of people using their own creativity and their desire to improve a school. And then you have a new model of what's possible. And that sometimes forces the public system to improve, because if you don't know what's possible, it's very hard for people to say, well, you can do better.
Well, my beefs with some of these charter schools, and I'm not saying all of them are bad, but some of them are obviously for-profit, and they're not interested in the welfare of the children, but more interested in increasing their profit line. And also, they talk about how some of these private schools, the students get much higher marks than public school students. Well, I think that's mainly because they get to pick and choose which students go in there. Public schools simply don't have that luxury.
That's definitely true. And the for-profit ones really haven't had much success. I mean, most of the best models of charter schools are not for-profit. That seems to be one of the things that that does corrupt the whole idea. You know, there are certain things that shouldn't be for profit. You shouldn't run a prison for profit. I don't think that you should run a school for profit. It just takes away from the sort of the integrity of what you're trying to achieve.
Right. Also, and not just that, but it also takes away from what you're attempting to accomplish. If you're doing something solely for the profit, then you're not going to go to the spirit of what you really need to do. In this case, educating children is the most important thing.
Right.
You know, it's less important how much money you're earning per student than it is to see how that student is going to develop and become a productive member of society in the future, and which is what we want.
Right.
Do you see everything moving more towards because there's all this talk about globalism, and I happen to be a very strong proponent of globalism, although not necessarily the corporate globalism. You know, I don't want a mech world, if you know what I mean. But do you think that there's a spirit of all the people like that, the social entrepreneurs and the people that they help, you know, working together and saying, look, we're tired of all the old governmental arguments and all the old military arguments. And do you think that eventually they'll just say enough and we'll have a truly global society, more than just a government, but a society of human nature?
Well, the nation states are going to, that's the way the world is going. It's really clear. And if you speak to the social entrepreneurs, you know, for my book, I interviewed 100 people in 12 countries. They're all building organizations and really advancing social changes. And if you speak to them, you see very much that there's a global citizen ethic. People really do, and not just in the field of the environment, where it's clear that action has to be taken at the global level, but in all sorts of fields, you realize that people do consider themselves and take as their reference points many other peoples in many other countries. And I think that that's growing, that's taking off. People now, when they buy coffee at Starbucks, you know, some people, not a lot of them, but a percentage of people now take into account the person who grew the coffee. Is that person getting a decent wage? I want to buy my fair trade coffee. I don't want just the regular coffee. I want to make sure that this person didn't get, you know, a dirt low price so that his family can't even feed themselves.
Well, unfortunately, the reverse of that, though, is that sometimes people here in this country are making so little money that they have to go to places that have lower prices. And one of the reasons that these places have lower prices is because they're spending a lot less on labor. I'd use Walmart as a prime example. Now, Walmart could have been considered, in certain extents, I consider them social entrepreneurs because of the way they keep track of what's being bought and what's being sold and know in advance where, you know, what they need to purchase for their stores. But certainly the way they treat their working people, you know, is not something you would want to emulate. How are you on that issue? Because Walmart is the biggest one, but it's not the only one that's doing that.
Well, I mean, the main way of looking at these things is you're trying to understand, are we in a downward spiral or are we in an upward spiral? Are the causes that we're creating, you know, creating more opportunities for people that ultimately 5 years down the road, they'll be in a better place than they are now. I have nothing against, you know, when I talk about social entrepreneurs, I don't actually say he has to run a non-profit or he has to run a for-profit or he can. The people that I've written about in my book, some of them are running non-profits. Some of them are running organizations that are governmental. Like I have a chapter about a man who was the head of UNICEF for 15 years, who was remarkably important in raising the worldwide vaccination rate, James Grant. Some people credit him saving 25 million lives.
Wow.
And I have another chapter on a guy in Brazil. This is really interesting. He has developed an approach to rent solar panels to very poor people in Brazil. What he did was kind of brilliant. He went around interviewing people, asking them how much they spend. These are people, there's 25 million people in Brazil who still don't have electricity. And as a result, they can't make a living in the countryside. So they have to flee their farms and go and live in the slums in the cities. Now, if you follow the news, Sao Paulo had 8,000 murders a couple of years ago. 8,000 murders. And that's because when you have millions of people fleeing the land in the countryside and moving into these slums in the cities can't absorb them quickly enough. And you get this tremendous health problem, you get a tremendous crime problem, and stuff like that.
Very similar to what happened in our big cities about 100 or so years ago.
Exactly, exactly. Fundamentally the same, and it's happening worldwide now. The rural to urban migration, if you look at, and the problem of terrorism, by the way, is very also closely related to that problem, because you put all these young, angry men together in cities. There's not employment for them. They're living in pretty lousy conditions. They're pretty ripe for anybody who wants to rile them up on any on pretty much any social issue. But anyways, getting back to Fabio Rosa in Brazil. So he went around and he asked people, how much are you actually spending on your candles and your kerosene and your batteries? And as it turned out, people were already spending about $12 or $13 a month. And then he thought, he'd been trying to sell solar panels to people. He'd been pretty successful, but he wasn't really able to sell the solar systems to very poor people because they were too expensive. But then it occurred to him one day, he said, why am I trying to sell this to people? It's like nobody sells me electricity. People rent it to me. I only pay for it every month. And a solar panel lasts 25 years. So he's essentially asking a poor person to give him 25 years of electricity use in advance, to pay him that way. And then he flipped the equation on its head, and he said, why don't I just rent it to them? So he went around, and he started renting these systems, $12, $13 a month, to people. They'd get the panel, they'd get the light fixtures and all sorts of things. And people started paying him back. So he set it up as a business. Because if a panel costs about $400, and you can rent it to a person for $12 a month, and the panel lasts 25 years, you know, you can figure out, you know, that it breaks even in about 4 years. You start making a profit in the fifth year, and profit's pretty good in the sixth year, and by the tenth year, you've made a great profit, and by the, you know, so that turns out to be a good business. And the reason why he set it up as a business is because the only way he can reach more and more people is if he can attract investment. He wants to grow this business so he can reach as many people as possible. He also set up a non-profit organization to do the same thing for very, very poor people. These are people who don't even spend $12 a month on their kerosene and batteries and candles. They might spend only $5 a month because they're so poor. So in their case, they'll still pay him, but they'll pay him a much lower monthly rate, and the system itself wouldn't recover its costs for maybe 10 or 15 years. And that could only be done in a non-profit way because investors are not that patient to get their money back. So he's got two systems, a for-profit business, a non-profit, and the goal in both cases is to do the same thing. It's to deliver solar power to poor people so that they can have viable lives in the countryside and they can continue to have a future, a rural future, without having to flee the land and contribute to this horrible urban problem that's plaguing Brazil and other parts of the world.
Right. Now, we had our own government-run rural electrification and the Tennessee Valley Authority and places like things like that that did wonders.
Absolutely.
For in fact, in the South, where they supposedly loathe the government so much, if it wasn't for federal programs like that, these people would still probably be without electricity in a lot of the rural areas.
Well, here's another example of, you know, when you know, what is the government, you know, what's the real strengths of the government? In the United States, I think 98% of the farms in the United States were electrified between 1935 and 1950 under sort of New Deal programs. Brazil, what did they have? They had a military dictatorship. And the military dictatorship didn't really care about those things. They cared about large industries and big cities, and they completely bypassed all these poor people. So, but what's interesting, from the point of view of the social entrepreneur, is the opportunity, the innovation. Like, there's 2 billion people in the world, Joe, who still don't have electricity.
Right.
2 billion. That's
one third. Yeah.
A third of the world. So, how are they going to get it? Are they going to be hooked up to the grid anytime soon? I don't think so. These poor countries don't have nearly the foreign investment to be able to expand their systems to all the villages. But if you can create a rental system that uses pretty much what people are already paying for their kerosene, and I've been to villages in Bangladesh. I spent a year in Bangladesh. I've been to villages in India. People need lights. They use candles. They use kerosene. They use whatever is available. And in addition to these things being fairly expensive for villagers, they're also really unhealthy for their children because they're inhaling the smoke inside the house, and they get all sorts of lung problems. And on top of it, all those people burning all those kerosene lamps contributes to quite significantly to global warming as well, because that's millions and millions of people, you know, producing carbon dioxide. So, and at the same time, the price of the solar panels is coming down. you know, every year, if you produce more and more, of course, it's just like the computers. It gets cheaper and cheaper.
And, of course, the technology is improving, so they're more efficient, I'm sure.
They're more efficient. The batteries are getting better. Battery is a very key thing in the whole thing because that's what stores the electricity. So all of the curves are moving in one direction so that this rental approach of solar electricity is absolutely going to take off. It has to because it's such an enormous need. At the same time, you might have heard of microcredit.
Right. I was just going to talk to you about that because that's the next step in it.
That's what I wrote my first book on. It was about the Grameen Bank of Bangladesh, which pioneered this approach of making small loans to women villagers. So the Grameen Bank lends money to almost 3 million villagers in Bangladesh. It's been doing this for 25 years.
And this is you're talking about really small loans, like $50, $100, couple hundred dollars here and there?
$100 a year, maybe. People pay it back $2 a week for 50 weeks. You know, it could be less, could be slightly more. But there's now 3,000 microcredit programs around the world since the Grameen Bank started in 1976,
And these are just very simple things. I mean, people who need, like, for example, materials so they can open up their little own sewing shop
exactly.
or something like that, or just do that from their home.
Even more basic, buy a cow, sell the milk. Buy some goats, sell the milk, make some cheese.
Sure.
It's really buy some bamboo, make a stool or a cane mat or something like that and sell it. Or if you're in a more, you know, if you have electricity or if you have more, it could be, manufacturing small products, you know, for example, manufacturing small wood products, you know, and you have a lathe or you have, as you were saying, a sewing machine or a rice husker or something like that. But over the last 10 years, the number of families that get microcredit in the world has gone from about 5 million to about 50 million. So that's about a quarter of a billion people.
That's remarkable.
Loans for self-employment. Now, if you look at the solar panel thing that I was just telling you about, this guy in Brazil, his name is Fabio Rosa. Why does he think that people are going to pay him every month? You know, they'll pay him the $13 that he's renting the system for. The reason why he knows that is because microcredit, this whole movement, is a previous sort of archaeological strata that he's standing on. He's standing on the foundation of this previous social change. The idea that poor people will repay their loans has been proven. The Grameen Bank demonstrated that, and many other organizations have also demonstrated that. Poor people are reliable. If you give them a fair deal, they will repay their loan.
Right, and if you try to screw them over, they'll try to do the same to you in the long run.
Exactly.
But if you treat them fairly, and I think most people are like that, if you treat them fairly, they'll treat you fairly in return.
And if you give them opportunity. So think about this. Fabio Rosa is renting solar panels to poor people in Brazil. The Grameen Bank now is renting cell phones to poor people in Brazil. They actually lease the phone. To a village lady, a poor person, she buys the phone and she pays it off in installments. In the meantime, she sells phone calls to everybody in the village who use the phone to call people in the head city, Dhaka, the capital city, or alternatively, they might call their cousin in New York who drives a taxi. Now, how many cell phones do you think the Grameen Bank has leased in Bangladesh?
I have no idea.
More than 60,000.
Wow.
It's actually... Bangladesh has a population of 120 million people. The 60,000 phones that the Grameen Bank leases to its what they call village phone ladies represents more than 25% of the entire cell phone market in the company.
That's
the country.
120 million people. How large is Bangladesh? Give us an example for like a state in the U.S.
Physically, about the size of New Jersey, I would say.
So you're talking about
Wisconsin.
It's
about the size of Wisconsin.
Well, roughly half the population of what the United States is, which is about 300 million.
Right.
Is lived in that one small area. Kind of like Japan, which has about 150, 200 million people in it, and that's about the size of California. Not even that with all the mountains. That's remarkable that people can live so tight. I mean, I grew up in New York, so, you know, as you're living in New York now, and it's incredible to some people how people can live in such crowded circumstances, but there are areas of the world that are much more crowded overall in a much larger area.
Oh, yeah.
And that leads to problems, too.
Now, one of the things, one of the points I just want to make in all this is, if you ask the average person on the street, you know, do you know that the, you know, number of poor people in the world who have access to loans for self-employment has gone from 5 million families to 50 million families, primarily over the last 7 years? you know, which is a quarter of a billion people being affected, you know, 99 out of 100 people walking down the street will say, wow, I've never heard of that. And, of course, why haven't they heard about it? This gets back to one of the central points that I make in my book. I say it over and over again. There are far more social entrepreneurs out there than we ever hear about that are doing remarkable things. There's far more social entrepreneurs in the world than terrorists. It's not even close. And their work is both deeper and wider.
But they don't sell papers, unfortunately. And they don't increase news ratings when people report on that.
It could be, or it also could be that the journalists have not yet adjusted to the new reality to realize there are all these new forces in the world that are very destabilizing. It's not just the nation states, and it's not just the forces of violence.
Well, considering what I've been hearing out of the American news over the last 2 or 3 years, I'm not sure that journalists have much to do with reality to begin with, and I've had some personal experience with that as well. The other press in the world, and in fact, the blogosphere, you might consider a form of social entrepreneurism, because here are people who are actively watching the media and watching the so-called professionals, and you know, getting them, you know, getting on their case when they get something wrong, and not just making a simple mistake like a typo, but getting entire entire ideas wrong, or just spouting lies, or just repeating something that the government told them. How do you see the blogosphere in terms of social entrepreneurship and that sort of thing?
Well, you know, I think that I actually, this is something that I could even ask you or ask your readers. I have a website, howtochangetheworld.org, but I have to say I'm sort of woefully inexperienced when it comes. I want to turn it into a blog, because right now it's just a sort of a flat website where people can just get some basic information. I don't know that much about the blogosphere, to tell you the truth. I've really spent the last 5 years traveling mostly in other countries, and I really haven't had a computer with me that much. So I'm not that familiar with the real impact of it. I mean, I go to blogs now and then, and I get some information, but what do you see? I mean, what do you think are the social changes that are coming, since you're so immersed in this, in the field?
Well, I think, if you look at it from a point of view of social entrepreneurs, people are tired of being told things by people who get paid a lot of money that are essentially not true.
Mm-hmm.
And some companies, like I use blogspot.com,
mm-hmm.
and they basically just, they give you space for free, and they put advertisements on it or something like that. And you can actually pay a small fee if you want to get rid of the advertisement. And basically, it's a very simple program that you just log into your website, and you can add a paragraph, or add a what's the word for it? Add a post. Excuse
mm-hmm.
me. See, I'm a radio talk show host, and I can't think of the words. Isn't that remarkable?
Look how far you've come.
And look how far I've come. Exactly. I get to all of 200 listeners. Woohoo! it's a way of getting your message out in public. I mean, there have been people who have been writing, you know, little newsletters and underground stuff for years and years, but this is just a way for more and more people to see it. The really big bloggers, guys like Atrios and Bart Cobb and people like that, they get seen by hundreds of thousands of people on a daily basis, and they are making an impact on the professional media, because they know now that if they do something that's completely out of whack, that there's somebody going to call them on it. And you know, if you wanted to put something together, it's really, really very simple. If you put together a simple web page, you can use HTML to a certain extent,
mm-hmm.
and HTML is very simple.
Mm-hmm.
So you could learn very quickly. I mean, I didn't know anything about HTML or anything like that, but I just sat down and, you know, I just, you know, a little trial and error and this and that, and anybody can do it. And I mean, and now it's not just the blogs, but the internet radio. I mean, I'm just one of many shows or people that are just doing these little shows that people just stream over the internet, and it's going to change the world. I really believe that.
The way you're describing it, it's very interesting. One of the patterns that I found, probably the most common pattern among the social entrepreneurs that I interviewed, is that whatever they're working on, they are ultimately unleashing the creativity and the potential of individuals to do more than they could do. So, for example, College Summit, they are taking these kids and unleashing their potential by helping them get to college so that they can do much more in their life and they have a much wider range of options. But one of the people I write about, a woman in India, Jeru Bilimoria, she created a network called Childline, which it's a network that protects street kids in India. And the way it works is that the street kids are actually employed by the system to be sort of paramedics. They field phone calls that come in from this emergency hotline, and they go and they rescue other street kids. And so she's unleashed their potential, not only to you know, help one another, but to actually be the people who run the system and ultimately make the policy decisions in how Childline should run. I see this pattern over and over again, and what you're reminding me of by talking about the blogging is just what bloggers are doing is they're making any individual, they're giving that much more power to try to figure out and find the sources of information that you need to make the decisions that you need to make in your life. So we're going from a sort of a command economy of information to a kind of a self-selected market economy of information where you can go, you figure out which bloggers you like, you trust, and then you can really inform yourself. Now, when we think about the field of social entrepreneurship, because this is a very fast-growing field, the .org boom, and when I say .org, I mean organizations that are nonprofit largely, is much, much, much bigger than the .com boom ever was. You know, and we didn't hear about this in the newspapers, but there are tens of millions of organizations that have been founded in the last 20 or 30 years around the world, most of them just in the past 10 years, to address social problems. And in countries where there used to be dictatorships or communists, like Poland and Hungary, you have this enormous explosion. Places like South Africa, where you used to have an apartheid government, enormous explosion. Brazil used to have a dictatorship until 1985. Hundreds of thousands of organizations just in the last decade. India, you know, where you had colonial regime up until previous generation. And even in the United States and Canada, in the U.S., the number of nonprofits has pretty much doubled in the last 12 years. All of these people are individuals who say, you know what, I'm sick of the government. I don't believe that the government is really, I think they have, their hands are in the pockets of business too much. They can't be free. Business only does things when they don't take into account the environmental or the human impacts of much of their work. But I see these problems in front of me, and, you know, what the hell, I'm going to go do something about it. And so they go and they just start something up, and sometimes it's small, sometimes it helps four people. But in a surprising number of cases, it spreads and it helps, goes from four to 30 to 60, and suddenly you're in the thousands, and then suddenly you're affecting policy. I don't mean suddenly in it happens in a day or two. It takes years. It takes 10 years usually to have at least the beginnings of an impact in your field.
Well, we see in American history that progressive movements always take about, you know, 10, 20, even 30 years to get moving. I mean, the New Deal did not happen overnight. That came because people for 60 years before that had been working on social issues. Jacob Riis's book shamed people in New York into making the social changes that eventually became the New Deal and, you know, the Populist Party back in the 1880s. You know, all of these things slowly grew up, and I think little things like, you know, the blogosphere, the Howard Dean campaign, not so much because of Dr. Dean himself, but because of how people managed to organize, you know, just around the Internet. I mean, it was a completely an unknown thing up until that time. And I think that's really going to change the way the world is. And it's just remarkable to watch it in progress. Now, the only hope is that we don't blow each other to bits before all these things can really come into place, because I think there's some very bad situations going on in the world right now. But I think in the long run, people will overcome that and things will be better. And I hope you believe that too.
Well, very much. I mean, the nation states will try to keep things. They'll try to hold on to the power as much as they can because, you know, look at the United States now. Look at the government. You know, here you have a problem, terrorism, international terrorism, which really knows no borders. You know, it's in a way, it's like cancer metastasizing in the body. And what their approach is to try to cut off an arm. Everybody who knows anybody who's had cancer knows that that's the problem with cancer. You can't just cut off an arm.
Right.
You can't just do a local treatment of it. You have to actually do a systemic treatment, you know, and if you can. And so what's the systemic treatment for terrorism? Well, basically the only systemic treatment for terrorism that's ever worked is to get every country or every police force or any, you know, who has any information that something's going on and get them sharing information
right.
So that they can, you know, You know, it's the same. In New York City, we have a program called Cop Shot, you know, that the police department started it. It's been very successful. If anybody anywhere in New York knows that it, knows of somebody who shot a police officer, they can call this toll-free hotline. They don't have to give any information about themselves, and they can get a $10,000 reward if their information leads to the capture of someone who shot.
Well, that would be difficult if they're anonymous.
Well, they somehow or other, I guess they have to, you know, when claim it, they have to somehow come into the station. But
we'll leave the $10,000 in a locker in Grand Central Station, and you can go pick it up there.
They've worked out the details. But the point is what are they doing? They're basically saying there's going to be thousands of people out there. We can't possibly know who they are, who will have the information that could help us do our jobs.
Well, I happen to think that the one of the other solutions to terrorism is to make the world a place where nobody would even consider doing something like that. I mean, well, to me, that goes without saying that if people are happy and they're supporting themselves and supporting their families and are happy in what they're doing, and that they have no reason to strap a bomb to themselves. And some of it is ideological and religious, and some of it is just as a result of economic policies that have basically made a few people very rich at the expense of a lot of very poor people.
Well, that's the deep, wise solution is to really look at the underlying causes of.
But unfortunately, it doesn't run a political campaign that way. I mean, these are really long-term processes that you can't just put into a soundbite. And I think once we get over this kind of insanity of the quick news bite and all that stuff, then maybe we can start thinking, you know, maybe this isn't such a good idea after all, and maybe we should try something long-term. Like you said, infiltration is another way of dealing with it. Certainly, attacking a country that had nothing to do with terrorism beforehand, I don't think is going to make us any safer. I mean, you know, but that's just, unfortunately, people react out of fear sometimes, and they allow governments to get away with a lot more than they should. And I'm very pro-government in the sense that understanding the progressive movement, I understand how government can have a huge impact. Like we talked about, rural electrification, that's one major example. Federal highway system. I'd like to see more of that across the entire globe. High-speed rail, cars that can stay on roads by themselves. You know, all these things can be done. I hate to cut this short because I'm having such a wonderful conversation, but we've been going on for about 45 minutes, and my show is only an hour long.
Okay.
So, Mr. Bornstein, I'd like to put something to you. Maybe if you're talking about blogosphere, maybe I can help you out. Maybe you would like to write something from time to time for the Cup of Joe blog and talking about how the social entrepreneurs can help working people, and then you can get involved with that too. In fact, I think I'll talk to Mark Satin and see if he wants to write something from time to time as well. Mark Satin wrote the book The Radical Middle, which is basically how we talk about how left and right stuff doesn't work as well as it used to, and we need to start looking at practical solutions to practical problems, and I think your book does that very well.
And if anybody out there can teach me how to or give me some quick insights into how to just turn my website into a blog. It's one of the things that I'd like to do. I have an 11-month-old baby now, so I find that I have no time for anything right now.
I understand.
But it's
completely.
One of my goals when I'm able to sort of have a little extra time in the next couple of months.
Well, let's keep in touch over email, and that way I can give you some basic instructions. In fact, I could probably set you up on Blogspot very easily. You can do that all by yourself. And you can just try it out for a little while and see how it works. And once you get used to it, then it just becomes a natural thing.
Okay.
So
my website is called howtochangetheworld.org.
Howtochangetheworld.org. No dashes, no underscores, no nothing. Just howtochangetheworld.org.
That's it.
In fact, I will put it on my website. In fact, I need to put the Radical Middle one on my website while I'm at it. Mr. Bornstein, thank you very much for talking. I wish we could spend all day talking. But, you know, I might give you a call every now and then to find out what new things are going on. If that's okay with you.
Sounds good. And hope your finger feels better.
Thank you, Mr. Bornstein, for being on my show, and I hope things continue to go well for you and for your book. And I see by the clock on the wall that's it for this episode of the Cup of Joe Radio Show. I will have more interviews as time goes by. I'm looking to have some people from Take Back the Media on next Thursday. So until then, take care. This is Joe Vecchio from the Cup of Joe Radio Show saying good night. Good night. Joe Vecchio, the host of the Cup of Joe Radio Show, is proud to be a member of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 2127. However, the views of Joe Vecchio do not necessarily represent the views of Local 2127, the IBEW, or its affiliate, the AFL-CIO. Please remember to support your working brothers and sisters and help keep the American dream alive. The Cup of Joe Radio Show has been a production of Jove Enterprises, Incorporated.